This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This is Sasha, and I will be here within the next hour. Our guest is an amazing, amazing author. He is a best-selling author of the extraordinary story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day. And the book is called Buried in the Sky, and his name is Peter Zuckerman. Welcome to the show, Peter.
It's great to be here.
Awesome. Before we jump into that, though, I just want to remind folks that KBOO is volunteer-run, so we're always putting call-outs for folks to get involved. You can, if you want to find out more about the Out Loud program, you can go to our website at kboo.com/outloud and listen to some prior episodes, or email us at outloud@gmail.com. And we're also on Facebook, so you can get updates through social media about what's happening on upcoming programs. But we've been around for a really long time, and we're going to be around for a really long time. So come down, get involved, and if Out Loud's not your thing, there's a lot of other areas. So come on down and join us. So the program, again, I'm going to go ahead and start the interview, is with best-selling author Peter Zuckerman, who has written an amazing book called Buried in the Sky, which is the story told from the perspective of Sherpa climbers of the disaster that occurred on K2. Could you talk about the book a little bit?
Yeah, Buried in the Sky is a true adventure story. In 2008, 11 people went up K2, which is a mountain between China and Pakistan. It's the second tallest mountain in the world, and it's largely considered the most difficult mountain in the world to climb. And within one day, 11 climbers died in the single deadliest day in the mountain's history. And Buried in the Sky tells the story through the eyes of the Sherpa climbers. And Sherpas, they hold a nearly mythical status among adventurers. But in a lot of books, their names aren't even mentioned. They're these unsung heroes of mountaineering. And this book, instead of telling it just through the eyes of the Westerners, it tells it through the eyes of the men who make high-altitude mountaineering possible.
Why is K2 so dangerous?
There's a lot of reasons. I mean, first, it's compared to Everest. It's very, very steep. It has a very slim profile. And then also part of it is just it's further north than Everest, so the weather is very unpredictable. And in a lot of years, nobody makes it up. And then it has all the normal hazards that of most mountains. It has, you know, these booby traps called crevasses, which can be covered with a layer of ice, and you step on one and you just slip right through. Or there's the altitude, and it's so high that nothing can live at that altitude for an extended period of time. So it's just, there are avalanches. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world.
And what was the genesis of, I mean, how did the idea come to write a book like this?
You know, my cousin, who is my co-author at the book, had a friend who died in the disaster. And she called me and she wanted me to write a book on this. And I said, no, that's a terrible idea. I'm not a K2 mountaineer, and I wasn't sure it was smart to spend the next 3 years trekking around, you know, Taliban-infested regions of northern Pakistan that are technically off-limits to journalists, especially when I'm a gay Jewish American, and the U.S. Embassy had told me to stay away from the region. I wasn't sure it would be smart to be going to parts of Nepal that were technically off-limits to journalists. And we didn't have a publisher. And I liked my job, and I honestly didn't know if anyone would be interested in the book. So initially I said, no, absolutely not going to do it. I looked into the story, though. I agreed to look into that because my cousin was really upset by her friend who had died in the disaster. And I've always loved adventure stories, and the 2008 disaster on K2 was one of the most compelling, dramatic stories I'd ever encountered. It's life and death on the limit of human endurance. It's triumph and tragedy on a peak that's so lethal most climbers commit it consider it suicide. And, you know, I'm researching this and I'm seeing photos of people just before they made decisions that caused people to live or die. And I said, gosh, this is a good story, but not going to do the book.
Yeah.
And then I looked at the characters. Uh-huh. And, you know, they're larger than life people. They were not the type of people that you run into every day. It takes a unique kind of personality to risk everything, to climb the world's most dangerous mountain. These are difficult people. They're trapped inside the same tents. They're fighting with each other when their life depends on them getting along. And you think you know who they are, and then right when things get bad, they reveal themselves to be someone different. And they put me in their shoes.
And it's what, sorry to interrupt, but is this, and from what I've read in your book, and this is a little different than, for example, Mount Everest, in that, you know, the folks that are going to K2 have to be in really awesome condition. And it's there is a lot more risk factor.
There's a huge risk factor. I mean, there's lots of ways to calculate the statistics, but roughly about a third of the people who make a serious attempt to go up die. Yeah. And most people who attempt to go up do not make it up. So it is a different kind of mountain. And I mean, it's a mountain where I felt like it really it forces people to figure out who they are. And the reading about it made me think about what kind of person I am, because you have to say, am I the kind of person who would go out there and try to save somebody's life, or am I somebody who would hang back? And would I try to save someone if I barely knew that person, or if they spoke a different language, or if they were a Sherpa? Yeah. And so I felt like it was a story that put me in their shoes.
So getting to that then, that very issue, why did you decide then to write the story? And maybe you could, you know, explain the distinction that I found pretty interesting in the book about what a Sherpa, you know, the issue of it being an ethnicity, and talk about, like, why did you decide to tell the story from their shoes?
Yeah, it wasn't because I thought there were good characters and a good story. That contributed. But it was really that I felt like there were other books that did that, and I felt like this story did something different, which is that it illustrates a much more universal problem about how we tell stories, and it's an issue that we all face nearly every day, all the time. What I mean by that is among mountaineers, Sherpas hold this, you know, this great status. They have this seemingly superhuman ability to go up and down mountains and do some of those dangerous and difficult climbing, and they scout the routes, they break the trails, they pitch the tents, they, you know, cook the food, they carry up the gear, they go down and bring their clients to the summit, they take the photo of their clients on the summit, they rescue their clients when they slip. And this is their job, to get their clients safely up and down a mountain. But in many mountaineering books, they're not even named. You hear these stories about this life and death rescue, but it doesn't mention who actually did the rescuing part of the rescue. And this is just something that had always bothered me. And because, you know, history is usually told from the perspective of the kings and the Columbuses, not through the eyes of the help. And I felt like this was a story that shows that when your life hangs from a knot, you need to know who tied it. You need to know if it was tied correctly. When you're putting together a team of people to lead you up a mountain, you have to know, do these people speak the same language? Can they get along? Will they work together? And so on a very broad level, what the story shows is that when you omit crucial aspects of a story, it can have disastrous consequences, and you might not even learn what they are. And so for the rest of us, for people who are not K2 mountaineers, which is much of the world, we're kind of in the same situation as the climbers. We're all hanging from knots that other people have tied. We all have mountains in our lives that we're trying to summit. We're all surrounded by people who we rarely pay attention to and sometimes don't even notice at all. You think the person who prepares your food at a restaurant, the last mechanic to check the plane before takeoff, you know, there are all these people. And I thought, you know, this book dramatizes the fact that Sherpas, they're all around us and that we can't afford to ignore them, that the Sherpas of every story need to be seen for whom they really are because our lives depend on them. And when I thought about that, with some help from and some nudging from my cousins, I thought, now this is a story that needs to be told.
That's thank you for that. That's Peter Zuckerman talking about his book Buried in the Sky, and you're listening to Out Loud on 90.7 KBOO FM. So you're a Jewish gay man, and you're taking on all of these risks, going to a completely new country with not a lot of knowledge about how things work. How did you do the research?
It was really hard. Mm-hmm. I remember when I got to Nepal, this was even before Pakistan, I got there with this idea that, oh, I'll just, go look these people up and do a sit-down interview. And I didn't realize some very basic things, like most Sherpas all have one of seven names. It's the day of the week they were born. Everybody born on Monday is named Dawa. Everybody born on Tuesday is named Mingma, all the way up to Sunday, which is Nima. And for a last name, most Sherpas just use the word Sherpa. And so I go and I'm trying to find a phone book, and you look through lists of names, and it's just, hundreds of pages of Pasang Sherpa. And almost all of these people are living in the same area. And, people try to gossip about each other, and it's just a dysfunctional system. People have to provide elaborate descriptions of the person they're trying to malign. They say, oh, yeah, you're looking for Tuesday, who's the son of Tuesday, whose sister is Tuesday and brother is Wednesday, who's the younger Thursday, whose brother's the younger Thursday in that family. And it was very confusing, and it was very hard to track people down. And it just took a lot of persistence. And I remember in a lot of cases, I would spend weeks trekking to a village trying to find somebody. And after, several days of getting tea with this person so they'd feel comfortable talking to me, they'd say, oh, you're in the wrong village. You have the mm-hmm. wrong Tuesday. You need to get the Tuesday at that village over there. And
building,
I mean,
trust.
So, yeah, I mean, a lot of it was just being really persistent mm-hmm. And finding people who are really helpful. It was a challenge from a reporter's standpoint. I couldn't do sit-down interviews, and it was a challenge getting places. And I remember at a point in Pakistan, there was a taxi driver who was telling me, we were discussing the murder of Daniel Pearl, and he was the Wall Street Journal reporter who was horribly murdered. And he was telling me, Daniel Pearl, he deserved to be murdered, and was kind of horrified. I'm like, no, no one deserves to be murdered, and he was doing good work. And he says, yeah, he was Jewish and traveling through Pakistan, and nobody should do that. That's like being an American and traveling through Pakistan. That's like being gay and traveling through Pakistan. And I remember thinking, oh my God, am I going to be murdered? Yeah. So, I mean, the reporting really was, yeah. I mean, it was the most challenging reporting I've ever done.
There was one, there's a lot of compelling stories in the book, but I was just kind of curious about if you could, talk a little bit about how you got involved with Chiring. Am I pronouncing Chiring's
name?
Yeah,
Chiring's name is correct. And Chiring is this frenetic personality. He can't sit still. He talks as though like every sentence is one long word and they're just a bunch of exclamation points at the end. And he was the first person I really found and a great help in this story. And he has a very heroic role in the book. At night, the ropes are cut off. He's going down the deadliest stretch of the most dangerous mountain, the bottleneck of K2. And he encounters another climber who's just stranded, who's lost his ice axe, who's just planning to die because rescuing somebody under those circumstances is suicide. And Chiring does the impossible. He ties this climber onto him so that he's literally hanging off Chiring. Oh, and they climb down this this wall of ice while these, boulders the size of buildings are breaking off. And they survive. And so I knew that was a story I was interested in reporting. And I tried to sit down with him, and it didn't really work. He's just too much of sitting down and talking to people wasn't quite he was more accustomed to talking to people while walking around and going places. Uh-huh. So I had him take me to his village, and you know, it was about, I think if I was in better shape, it would have been, you know, a week to get there. But for me, it was a week and a half, and I wasn't so great with the altitude at that point. And so we went to his village, and I just interviewed him every day ended up being like a month, just interviewing him every day, all day, and uh-huh. living with him, and then later living with his family.
Yeah, really, really neat, really great story. We're talking to Peter Zuckerman, who's talking about his book, Buried in the Sky, and we're going to take a little bit of a musical break right now and come back for more of the interview. Welcome back. You're just listening to Miriam Makeba's Table Mountain. This is Out Loud, Portland's queer culture radio program, and this is Sasha, and I'm here with Peter Zuckerman, the author of the award-winning from the National Outdoor Book Award, the Banff Mountain Award, and the George Orwell Prize-winning book, Buried in the Sky. Outside magazine called it easily the most riveting and important mountaineering book of the last decade. Wow, it's pretty amazing credentials there, Peter. So like, I'd like to know just a little bit more, you know, going back to, you know, the issue of Sherpa identity. I'd like to know, like, could you flesh out a little bit about the distinction between the way that word is used?
Yeah, so Sherpa is a confusing word because to some people it's a job description and to some people it is an ethnic group. And from an ethnic standpoint, it's also a really complex word because there are all these different Sherpa clans that all want to call themselves Sherpas, but they don't want the other clans to call themselves Sherpa. Let me explain a little more. So Sherpa, which originally comes from a Sherpa word called Sharwa, which means people of the East. It's the Sherpa name is sort of like a brand name. People, Westerners, come to Nepal and they want to hire a Sherpa. They've heard about the Sherpas, they've read about the Sherpas, and hiring a Sherpa seems like a really smart idea. The problem is they don't know what a Sherpa is. So they come in saying, I want a Sherpa. And so all these people come and say, oh, I'm a Sherpa. And their business competitors say, no, he's not a Sherpa. I'm a Sherpa. Mm-hmm. And so what's happened is all these different ethnic groups have started to claim the word Sherpa and claim that identity. And then what's ironic is the man who made the Sherpas famous, Tenzing Norgay, was actually didn't identify as a Sherpa when he was on the top of Everest and became really famous. It was this expedition that called him a Sherpa. And after that, everybody wanted to hire Sherpas. So there are all these different ethnic groups that are claiming the Sherpa identity. And some of them have had the Sherpa identity for longer than others. And the ones who just most recently had it say it's not an ethnic identity at all. It's a job description. And there's sort of this battle among these different ethnic groups claiming that they're Sherpas. And the money at stake is really high because it's the difference between, you know, feeding your family for a year or not, because climbers want to hire a real Sherpa. And trekkers do too. And so what the term means is disputed and people have very strong opinions about it, but it's hard to say exactly what the word means.
Yeah. And just, this is a huge conversation and it might be not a great question, but I'm just curious what your thoughts are, you know, about the influence of Western money on the Sherpa community and the impact it's had, for example, with, you know, the Maoist revolution and what happened. I mean, if you want to touch on what happened with the palace, you know, and if any of those issues are related or, you know.
Absolutely. So before Westerners were climbing in the Himalaya and the Karakoram, the villages, these mountain villages, were very, very isolated.
What's the Karakoram?
That's another mountain range that hooks into the Himalaya. That's actually, K2 is technically in the Karakoram. And so the villages were so isolated that actually each village arguably has its own language. And that the trade between them was very limited because of the steep terrain. Then Westerners came through, and they were much wealthier than the Sherpas. And these villages that had all these great traditions and stories and customs, and in a lot of cases, the elders say the world started at that particular village, or that it was a place that the Buddha had done something very significant. The young people in the village just started to leave and get jobs climbing the mountains, and that was seen as sacrilegious by the elders because the gods lived in the mountains, and it created this battle between the younger Sherpas and the older Sherpas. And now the younger Sherpas have largely just left the villages, and there's just the old people living in the villages, and the younger Sherpas have left to Kathmandu, which is the major city in Nepal. And on the one hand, it seems like it's kind of sad because this culture and this history of tradition is just dying. But on the other hand, I can relate to it. You know, it's the villages have a lot of things, but one thing they don't is, you know, phones and electricity and running water and antibiotics and petroleum and a lot of basic amenities. I mean, not in all cases, but in many cases. And, you know, getting to a village can take weeks of backpacking. And, you know, if you want a more comfortable life, you want your children to get rich, it's hard to have that opportunity in the village. So the villages are largely deteriorating, which is, you know, sad and happy at the same time.
And I know that you said that when you went to Nepal, we're expecting challenges and you were unsure about how the experience was going to be. And I read on your bio that you had an unpleasant experience dealing with something that was defined as maybe half animal, half plant.
Yes. That's actually kind of an accurate description. It's also called the secret elixir to life. It's called the Himalayan Viagra. It's called Yasagumba. And what it is it's a worm, a ghost moth larva, and it's infected with the spore from a mushroom. And the infected worm crawls into the ground and it mummifies, and a new mushroom shoots out of its head and the cycle continues. And this is this Chinese medicine that while I'm trekking to Hungung, which is about 3 weeks from Kathmandu, at least for me, I'm not that fast. And people are raving about it. They say, you know, if you take this, it'll solve all your problems. And if you don't take this, it's going to be really bad for your karma. And in fact, there was an American who came through here once who didn't take it. And the next day, he was killed in a rock avalanche. And they take karma very seriously there. And you know, I was basically told, like, we're not going to be near you if you don't take this, if you get the opportunity to take it. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was all a whole scam, I later figured out, but I didn't know this at the time. So then I bought some Yasagumba at some point, and I shared it with the team of translators I was with. And, you know, it tasted kind of like, it had the consistency of a twig, and maybe it tasted like English breakfast tea, maybe. And, you know, I'm eating it, and I'm ready for my life to dramatically change. And soon we are really high. And I mean, drugs are not for everybody, but they were working for me. I would say I did not participate in this aspect, but the Himalayan Viagra part was true. And all these people of the group I was with were hooking up. We started eating all this food that just tasted amazing. And, you know, like dal lentils tasted like, you know, truffles with A1 steak sauce. And, And things are really good, and after a while I feel like, okay, I'm going to go to sleep. And then I'm woken up in the middle of the night by one of our interpreters, and she tells me, Peter, everybody is dying. And I crawl out of my tent, and there's Pasong, one of the main characters of the book, and my friend at this point, and he's on the ground, he's convulsing, he's foaming at his, out, you know, at the mouth, his eyes just look... His eyes are like freakishly wide open, and I don't know what to do. So I try to call my cousin on the satellite phone that I had with me, but it was really low on batteries, so I'm only able to get through a very short call. And I try to explain what happens, and she says, "So Peter, let me make sure I got this right. So you're in a remote village in the Himalaya, and you just overdosed on a worm with shrooms growing out of its head, and you've killed everybody, all these main characters in our book, and you want an evacuation on a helicopter that's from the Soviet era." And I'm trying to explain to her that, well, yes, this is the case, but it's not as strange as it sounds, which maybe it was. And the line goes dead, so I don't find out what happens. And so then I go, and I don't know what to do, so I try to find a local doctor. Me and the one translator who was okay went, and asked the doctor. I said, "Well, what can you do? And the doctor said, "Oh, well, I can take blood pressure. And I can do all these rituals." And I say, "Oh, well, take blood pressure," because I didn't know what else to do.
Sure.
And so the doctor takes my blood pressure and says it's like 27. I was thinking, oh, wow, blood pressure seems like it's two numbers. But says, no, look at the dial, it's 27. And the doctor starts taking blood pressure of other people who are really sick and basically tells me, "I'm sorry, they're dead. This is, you know, look, their blood pressure is zero. It's over. The only thing we can do are these rituals." And so I say, okay, well, let's do these rituals. I don't know what else to do. I'm really freaked out. I go back to my tent. I start crying. I'm thinking, why did I do this? And I just feel awful. And then we start doing all these rituals. We do like the corn ritual and the birth ritual. And, you know, I just say, well, let's do every ritual we can. And I gave the healer, you know, $5, which is a lot of money for the area, to help me do all the rituals. And all these villagers came out, and, you know, their drums banging, and there's incense burning, and there's this stick type thing that's being waved around and hit on people's heads. And people start to get better. And so, and this goes on. Oh. This goes on for a couple days. I'll say that I'm really, really tripping out during part of this. The time is a little confusing, and we start to get better. And so we just keep doing these rituals, and then we're kind of starting to be able to walk again. And out of the sky comes the scariest looking helicopter you've ever seen. this, I mean, it looked like a a school bus tied into a bow. I mean, it was a scary, scary helicopter, and it lands and looks like this, you know, kicks off all these dusts. It looks like a mushroom cloud when it lands. And the villagers had seen helicopters in the sky before, but they'd never seen one up close. So they all come running to the helicopter pilot, and he says, "I'm here to pick you up." And I peer into the cab of the helicopter and see, you know, this torn seat and this ancient, like, and it's maybe not ancient, but it looked like this ancient script. It was probably just Russian script.
Yeah.
On the dash, and I'm thinking, oh, no way I'm going to take this helicopter. But everybody really wants to take the helicopter, and I'm kind of starting to feel really good of coming down from the Yasagumba. And so we go down the helicopter, and I remember this trip so well because we were feeling so good. And before that, I'd felt so depressed and so horrified by what I was doing. And at that point, I just felt wonderful. I felt like, I'm going to get this book done. I'm going to go all out to research it. We are going to make this happen. And you know, Pasong, who I'd had this sort of difficult relationship with, the main character, he and I suddenly became really good friends after surviving this. And I felt like, I just felt so much better. And it was, bizarrely, it was a turning point in the book. And I kind of feel like in my life, this near-death experience somehow, you know, helped me really want to live and live life to its fullest. And it made me think that maybe all these stories about the half plant, half animal are true, that they give people this great sense of purpose in their life. So that was one of many research adventures. So
that's wonderful. Thanks for sharing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
We're going to take another quick break, a little music break. And before we go, I just want to remind folks that you're listening to 90.7 KBOFM, and we're interviewing Peter Zuckerman, the best-selling author of the book Buried in the Sky, which is a story of the Sherpa climbers on K2's deadliest day.
I'm looking out for you among the flies that wait in line for days on end, nights so cold, always so intense. Try to reach the top. Up to the sky, but the cover hangs so low, I see no sign of life. Nothing springs to mind among the flies that wait in line for days on end, the nights so cold, always so intense. Going on, you and me have always gotten through. Anyone can tell you that it's true, but you feel it every time you drive away from home. The headlights hypnotize, and they take you off towards the sea, into the night. You run away thoughts you cannot hide. They can't die, can't describe my hunger for your billowing
week. You just want to go on for a long time. A long week.
Welcome back to Out Loud. You were listening to Neil Finn singing The Climber. And our guest on Out Loud this evening is Peter Zuckerman, who's talking about his book, Buried in the Sky. Welcome back, Peter.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Hey, so I just want to ask you this question. Often when I ask out musicians, you know, that come onto the program about what it's like to be, you know, openly gay or transgender in, you know, the music industry, it's kind of a non-issue. They're just, you know, it's not, according to what the responses have been, that, you know, it's not really something that's shaped their art or, you know, been a factor in what they do. And I'm just curious, because I haven't had the opportunity to talk to a lot of, you know, openly gay writers, especially writers that are doing work in fields that aren't necessarily saturated with, you know, openly gay and transgender writers. So I'm just curious, like, what that experience has been for you, what that looks like.
I mean, mountaineering is a very macho industry, and there are not many gay or trans mountaineers, especially who are climbing the highest mountains in the world. And there are not many people who are gay that I know of who write adventure stories. And if there are, it's not something that's really discussed much. And in the disaster I wrote about, there was someone who was gay, but he would not let me write about it at all, and was horrified that I'd figured it out. I didn't confront him with it or anything.
Right.
And so it's kind of lonely, to be honest, because there are not many role models, but it sometimes can make the reporting difficult, because especially when I'm in countries like Pakistan, where it's illegal to be gay and people are killed for being gay, it can be kind of scary, because somebody can Google my name and it's not that hard to find out about my personal life. So I don't deny it. I just try to not bring it up, largely out of safety concerns. And then, you know, sometimes when people get to know me, it doesn't matter so much anymore. But it's hard. And I wish more people in the sport and more people who are doing, you know, writing serious adventure stories would come out.
Thank you. Would you mind reading an excerpt from your work? Do you have anything like that ready?
Yeah, I can. I have a good excerpt from the beginning.
That'd be great.
Which I can read. It's the book's about a mountaineering disaster, and the entire disaster lasts 27 hours. And I'm going to read an excerpt that is from a scene that occurred a little less than halfway through. Hanging off the face of a cliff, an ice axe the only thing between him and death, a Sherpa climber named Cheering Dorje swung to the left. A massive ice boulder ripped off above, hurtling toward him. It was the size of a refrigerator. The underbelly caught and the mass flipped, cartwheeling down. It tore past Skimming's Cheering's shoulder, then vanished. Broof! It slammed into something below, shattering. The mountain shook with the impact. Powder shot up in a column. It was near midnight on August 1st, 2008, and Cheering had only a hazy idea of where he was, on or near the bottleneck of K2, the deadliest stretch of the most dangerous mountain. At roughly the cruising altitude of a Boeing 737, the bottleneck stretched away from Cheering into the darkness below. In the starlight, the channel seemed bottomless as wisps of fog slithered into the abyss. Above, a lip of ice curled like the barrel of a crashing wave. Oxygen depletion had turned Cheering's mind to mush. Hunger and exhaustion had broken his body. When he opened his mouth, his tongue froze. When he gasped for breath, the moistureless air scoured his throat and lashed his eyes. Cheering felt robotic, cold, too tired to think of what he'd sacrificed to get to K2. The Sherpa mountaineer, who had summited Everest 10 times, had been consumed by K2 for decades. A far more difficult peak than Everest, K2's summit is one of the most prestigious prizes in high-altitude mountaineering. Cheering had gone despite his wife's tears, despite the climb costing more money than his father had made in 40 years, despite his Buddhist Lama warning him that K2's goddess would never tolerate the climb. Cheering had made it to the summit of K2 that evening without using bottled oxygen, vaulting him into an elite group of the most successful mountaineers, but the descent wasn't turning out as planned. He had dreamed of the achievement, a heroic reception, even fame. None of that mattered now. Cheering had a wife, 2 daughters, a thriving business, and 12 relatives who depended on him. All he wanted was to get home, alive.
Oh, thanks, Peter. That was Peter Zuckerman reading from his book, Buried in the Sky. Could you talk a little bit about like what you found to be the most challenging and the most rewarding pieces of the work?
The most challenging part was definitely the research and just the logistics of getting around the concept of day calendars and being on time and talking to foreigners is just not very common. And the languages would be so rare that they're only spoken in that village or that region. And so I had to go through multiple layers of translators. And I would ask questions that just didn't culturally make sense that I thought would. You know, I'd ask, how old are you? And it would go through a couple translators. And then the answer would come back after lots of strange conversations and looks between the translators that the answer would be, I was born in the winter of the Buddha's, you know, this festival. And I'd think, oh, well, how many years do you have? And come back and they'd say, well, I'm 236. And because being old is very prestigious in these villages. So a lot of times just being able to communicate was a major challenge. And staying healthy was a big challenge and safe. When I wasn't sick from, you know, altitude or food or something else, there was, you know, there was the Taliban to deal with. There was the war with India, which wasn't very active at the moment in Pakistan. But there was, you know, you just sometimes you had to move really fast and it could be scary. So I think that was the biggest challenge. The biggest reward was, first, I met some amazing people. And I mean, I can't say how grateful I am. I mean, they were willing to talk about some of the most dreadful things that have ever happened and let me see the world through their eyes and tell me about the deaths of their loved ones and of people they saw die just before them because of a mistake they had made. And you know, it really felt like an honor to be trusted with that information. And I really think the book has had an impact in how people look at mountaineering disasters, that, you know, the Western perspective matters, but so does the guy who's carrying the gear and setting the ropes and escorting the climber to the summit. And that, you know, now more frequently, you know, the high altitude workers, their names are included in books and in reports, and that is seen as the story of the people who are so often overlooked is now being included. And I think that might even lead to some people surviving and fewer disasters on mountains, just because it avoids people making some really obvious mistakes, like putting together a team of people who you think are the same ethnic group because they all identify as Sherpas without and you know, now people might say, hey, these people actually speak different languages and are business rivals and don't like working together. Maybe we shouldn't put them all on the same team. And I like to think that those are discussions that might come out as a result of this book among mountaineers.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. That was Peter Zuckerman talking about his book, Buried in the Sky, The Extraordinary Story of the Sherpa Climbers on K2's Deadliest Day in 2008. Peter, I wouldn't mind just changing gears for a second and talking a little bit about some of the other work that you do. I understand that you work with communications at Basic Rights Oregon.
Yeah, I'm part of a communications team there. Working on a variety of topics there.
And I just wanted to ask you, there's some huge news, you know, that Basic Rights Oregon, well, actually Oregon United for Marriage, is going to be moving forward with the Freedom to Marry and Religious Protection Initiative in the 2014 ballot measure cycle. Is that right?
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. It's a moment we've been waiting for a long time, you know, with the win in Washington, with wins all over the country. We have lots of people lining up behind us, and now is our moment. It's we've been on the defensive for decades, and now we are going to win the freedom to marry for all Oregonians. And I really feel like that's the right thing to do, and I'm really excited about that effort. And I'm also excited about the other things that Basic Rights Oregon is doing. They're working for trans-inclusive healthcare. We're working for racial justice. I just feel like these are great causes, and it's an honor to be able to work on them with so many amazing people.
And just for just as a little more background, folks might not know it, but Oregon's faced more anti-gay and lesbian ballot measures than any state in the country. We were used as a testing ground for the religious right back in the 80s and 90s, you know, to see if something would stick to the wall here, and then they could, you know, apply it in other states. In fact, at the same time that there was the ballot measure 9, which was a horrifying ballot measure that would have restricted a lot of rights for gays and lesbians, was being defeated in Oregon, thank God. It was actually passed in Colorado, a similar measure, and it had to go all the way to the Supreme Court to get struck down. So, so that's just a little more background on. For years, we have been fighting back against, you know, our opposition and people who, you know, would bully our families, and now we're proactively seeking, you know, the freedom to marry. So it's a really wonderful day, actually, because I understand that Oregon United for Marriage actually dropped off their sponsorship signatures today.
Yeah, that happened today. It's the first step of a process to get the freedom to marry on the ballot in 2014. We gathered all those signatures in less than a week. And I think that really just shows how much momentum and how much excitement is behind this.
Did you want to talk about the trans-inclusive healthcare at all?
I would love to talk about trans-inclusive healthcare. I think it's a really important issue that is too often overlooked. You know, for cisgender, for people who are, for lack of another word, non-transgender, I think, you know, I don't have to think about a lot of the care I get. But, I mean, imagine if you you did the same work as everybody else, you paid into the same health insurance plan as everyone else, but you were denied the same benefits strictly because of your gender. That just feels wrong. And trans-inclusive healthcare is the right thing to do. It's a matter of basic equality, and it's inexpensive. It's actually costs a negligible amount, and it's something that I really support, and I'm really proud of Oregon, which has become one of the most trans-inclusive states in the country, and it's an issue that I feel like all Oregonians should care about, because we all care about basic equality.
Thanks, Peter. That was awesome. And there's just a couple of other stories I just kind of wanted to ask you about if we have time. There was a really interesting story involving Lieutenant Colonel Linda Campbell that I was hoping you could talk about.
Yeah. So Lieutenant Colonel Linda Campbell, she's been in the armed services in one way or another for about 20 years. She comes from a military family, really an amazing, sweet person. And her partner got cancer and had cancer for a long time, for 10 years before she died. And, you know, for obvious reasons, Linda was very, very upset about this. And Linda's family members I think they've all been buried in the Willamette National Cemetery, which is where a lot of veterans are buried together. And Linda wanted to be able to have her partner buried in that cemetery because that's where she was going to be buried, and that's what they'd planned for. But they learned that, at first they learned that that would not be allowed to happen. And the case went way up to, I think it might have gone all the way up to the White House, I don't know.
Because of the Defense of Marriage Act.
Because of the Defense of Marriage Act prevented them from being buried in the same place. And it's amazing. She won. It's probably the first time that a same-sex couple will be able to be buried together in a veterans cemetery, and it means so much to her. And I mean, it shows the journey that our country is going on. That more and more people, more and more Oregonians, and more Americans are just coming to realize that. That treating others as one would want to be treated includes allowing, you know, same-sex couples to marry, includes treating them as equals. And it makes me really happy to see the progress that we've made.
Yeah, and, you know, a huge thanks to Brad Avakian and Senator Jeff Merkley for helping to facilitate that process.
They've been tremendous. You know, they largely are who made that happen. And also, I think Linda just to have to work with that right after her partner has died. That takes a lot of courage and strength. And I mean, I just think she's really an amazing person to have made that happen.
In another news, there was a Williams Institute study done, released today, that listed the states with the highest gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender populations. I think that it might just be LGB, though. I read two different versions of that, so I'm not going to go on record saying it's the T, but it's definitely the LG. And it was really interesting because I don't know if you wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I read the study and I was excited. It builds. It was done by Gallup, which is a good polling firm, mm-hmm. And it claims to be the most comprehensive study, and it says, and it gives an idea of the percentage of people who are gay and maybe bisexual and trans. That was not quite clear to me either.
Yeah.
And District of Columbia is number one with 10% of the population, but Oregon is up there. It is number 1, 2, 3, 4. Oregon, 5% of the population. You think 5%, that's 1 in 20 people.
Yep.
Are
so
gay.
So if you're at a party.
So yeah, if you're at a party, you'll find somebody. And I think, you know, that's just the people who are out.
Yeah.
And so it makes me happy to see that, you know, people are becoming more comfortable with whom they are.
Mm-hmm. Although North Dakota's got some work to do.
Yeah, this is true.
Incidentally, I'm going there this summer to visit my grandma. Looking forward to it.
Well, you're at the leading edge. You're making the difference.
And my grandma is super supportive. So
that's great. That's great,
yeah. Anyway, so we've got a couple of minutes left. Can I pick your brain on parting thoughts and feelings about your book, Buried in the Sky, and anything else you want to opine on?
Let's see. I think on the most fun, like just to put it, to bring everything together, the issue I've been most passionate about and what connects the work I do for LGBT equality and in this book is that it's largely about people who have been brushed aside, who have not been treated well, who are there but often unseen. And, you know, in the book, it illustrates that you can't ignore people who are unseen, because in some instances that can lead to people dying, and that the disaster really illustrates that we need to know about our coworkers, and we need to care about all kinds of different people. And the work I've done as an investigative reporter has also been along that theme. And so is the work I do with Basic Rights Oregon. And that, you know, I'm really happy because I feel like there's been so much progress in that, in those realms. And I mean, to me right now, it seems crazy that, for example, someone could be told it's illegal to... can you imagine being told it's against the law for you to marry the person you love, even though you've been in this loving, committed relationship for decades and decades? And to see that that's not always going to be the case. We're going to win. And more and more frequently, people are paying more attention to minority groups and to people who have been brushed aside. And that makes me so excited for the future. And I think that that's a theme that has connected a lot of the work I've done.
Awesome. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Peter. That was Peter Zuckerman. He is the best-selling author of the award-winning book, Buried in the Sky, The Extraordinary Story of the Sherpa Climbers on K2's Deadliest Day. We're just going to go into a little music, and I'll just say goodnight. So I just want to remind everybody to keep on living out loud and stay proud.
Marry me a little, love me just enough. Cry, but not too often. Play, but not too rough. Keep a tender distance, so we'll both be free. That's the way it ought to be. I'm ready, marry me a little. Do it with a will. Make a few demands I'm able to fulfill. Want me more than others? Not exclusively, that's the way it ought to be. I'm ready. I'm ready now. You can be my best friend. I can be your right arm. We'll go fight or two, no harm, no harm. We'll look not too deep, we'll go not too far. We won't have to give up a thing, we'll stay who we are. Right. Okay then. Love me just enough, warm and sweet and easy, just the simple stuff. Keep a tender distance, so we'll both be free. That's the way it ought to be. I'm ready, marry me a little, body, heart and soul. Passionate as hell, but always in control. Want me first and foremost, keep me company, that's the way it ought to be.
KABU is proud to sponsor two special Black History events at Portland State University on Thursday, February 21st, featuring East Coast MC, educator, and community organizer Hassan Salam. First is a multimedia presentation on the history of Black music titled From Spiritual to Hip Hop. This will take place at noon at the Smith Memorial Union on the second floor. The second event is a hip-hop show with local progressive artists, Sirens Echo, and March 4th. This will happen at 7 p.m. at the Food for Thought Cafe in the basement of Smith Memorial Union. That's two special events with Hassan Salam in celebration of Black History Month on Thursday, February 21st at Portland State University. More information can be found at kabu.fm/Hassan2013.
It's a new year, and Black History Month is now upon us to reflect the issues unique to Black African peoples. Join me, Sequoyna Wright, a KABU volunteer regular, every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. for the month of February, starting February 2nd, as I discuss with special guests Tariq Nasheed, Dr. Umar Johnson, Dr. Claude Anderson, and my very own father about the present state of Black America. Topics include love and relationships, mental health, music, and economics. Tune in and join in on the conversation on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The time is 7:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's time for Hard Knock Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Welcome to Hard Knock Radio. Today on the program, Davey D speaks with Mark Gonzalez, an activist, scholar, and poet, to discuss the impact that hip-hop is having in places like Palestine and India.
And you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
How can I betray the youth and don't tell them fatal truth? This is why we hate the troops. This is no tomato juice. This is Kanan on Hard Knock Radio. Peace, peace.
Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. Hard Knock Radio in the building with us this afternoon. Coming straight out of Palestine, or at least that's where he'd be hanging at. Hello.